Iran and the remaining JCPOA signatories meet again in Vienna to try to revive the international accord.
Well, our position is quite clear. All sanctions should be lifted. All sanctions which are mentioned in the JCPOA, and any new sanctions imposed after the adoption day of the JCPOA, including everything during Trump administration.
Yemeni forces allied with the Ansarullah movement make more advances in the battle for the liberation of the strategic city of Ma'rib, north of the country. And a warning by hundreds of former and serving members of the French military about a threat of civil war sparks controversy in the country. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in for World News. A top story, Iran and the remaining JCPOA signatories meet once again in Vienna to try to revive the accord. An exclusive interview with Press TV, Iran's top negotiator Abbas Araghchi brought us up to speed on the latest developments in the talks.
Before the session, we had a number of bilateral and trilateral meetings between Iran and other delegations. We had a very important trilateral meeting with China and Russia, in which we coordinated our positions, and it's actually great that we have common positions with Russia and China in many issues, almost on all issues, and there is a good understanding between the three delegations. We decided to intensify the work of the two working groups on sanctions lifting and on nuclear, and we also decided to have the third working group starting its job from tomorrow. The third working group is called Practical Arrangements, and the purpose is to find ideas and solutions for the question of verification, the implementation day, timetable for implementing commitments by the measures by all parties. It has been the United States who left the JCPOA, who withdrew from the JCPOA. It is the United States who should come first, who should implement its obligations and lift all of its sanctions. And then Iran would verify, and after open verification, Iran would restart its obligations in the JCPOA. We decided to establish the third working group. The third working group is called Practical Arrangements. In the Practical Arrangements working group, there are several issues to be addressed. One important issue is the verification, that how things should be verified, how the sanctions lifting should be verified. The question of sequence, we insist on our position. Also we will talk about the implementation day, the timetable to achieve that, and for timetable for all parties to do their measures. Well, our position is quite clear. All sanctions should be lifted. All sanctions which are mentioned in the JCPOA, and any new sanctions imposed after the adoption day of the JCPOA, including everything during Trump administration. This is our position, it's quite clear, and we are working to come to a conclusion which meet our demands on the sanctions lifting area. We better leave the details of negotiations to the experts to come to a conclusion. One important question is the question of conversion of different currencies. We are working on that, and we hope we can come to a good conclusion on it. We monitor very closely the behavior of the other parties. We would certainly not go for time-consuming, negotiations with no result. As soon as we see that the other side is not serious and try to waste the time for maybe other purposes, we would certainly stop negotiations. We haven't seen this approach in the other side. We believe that all parties are serious to continue negotiations, but we follow these negotiations, we conduct these negotiations with our eyes open.
The Yemeni army and allied answer low forces have made remarkable advances in their battle to liberate the strategic northern city of Marib. Sources say that Yemeni armed forces engage in heavy clashes with Saudi-backed militants at the Mashqa front line. They're said to be just about 4 kilometers away from the city. The Yemeni army on Sunday also managed to take full control of the Qusayrah area and made progress on the western front lines as well. Marib is the last northern stronghold of fighters loyal to a former Saudi-backed president, Abu Mansur Hadi.
Amid the continued advancement of the Yemeni army in the city of Marib, the Saudi-led coalition has begun to build new military camps in Shabwa and Al-Wadi'a areas to deploy more troops in the city.
What the Saudi-led coalition has in mind by building new military camps in Shabwa and Al-Wadi'a areas shows that the coalition is losing the control of Marib. It is now desperately trying to keep the city under its control, but the Yemeni army is determined to liberate all Yemeni lands.
The latest measures by Saudi-led coalition in Marib comes after Yemeni army backed by allied fighters from popular committees took control of strategic areas, including Tum al-Ulya Hill, which is 4 kilometers away from the western neighborhoods of the city of Marib.
Al-Tuma al-Ulya Hill has a great military and strategic importance as it can provide Yemeni army with a good opportunity to achieve its military goals. The hill overlooks the city of Marib, so the Yemeni army will be able to target the enemy inside the city.
The Yemeni army has also intensified its retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia. Earlier, Yemeni troops launched an attack with a drone of Qasif K2 against King Khalid Airbase in Asir in retaliation for the ongoing Saudi war and siege.
Yemenis say their army will continue its operations to liberate all the Yemeni lands, including the oil-rich province of Marib, the last stronghold of Saudi Arabia in northern Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana.
About 1,000 members of the French military have warned of a deadly civil war in the country. An open letter signed by hundreds of servicemen and women, including some 20 retired generals, says certain anti-racism is dividing communities and igniting an impending racial war. They claim that entire parts of the nation's territory are being overrun by what they're calling Islamists. Far-right leader Marine Le Pen, who is to run for president next year, has supported the former generals and called on them to join what she called her battle for France. But ministers have condemned the letter and called for those who signed it to be punished. The letter comes on the 60th anniversary of a failed coup against General de Gaulle by generals opposed to Algeria's independence. Russia holds naval drills as a U.S. Coast Guard vessel is headed to the region amid heightened tensions between Moscow and the West. Russia's Black Sea Fleet says a cruiser is set to hold live-fire drills with other ships and military helicopters. The move comes following a U.S. announcement that a cutter was moving into the Black Sea to work with NATO allies and partners in the region. Russia says this troop buildup near the border with Ukraine is part of drills in response to what it calls threatening behavior by NATO. Meanwhile, Moscow has accused the U.S. and its allies in Europe of contributing to an increased military threat in the region with their actions.
The growth of military threat is fueled by the activities of the United States and NATO in the European region. They increase the combat readiness of troops and strengthen their presence.
The Russian defense minister criticized NATO for deploying its modern military infrastructure and carrying out operational combat training in Europe. Shoigu also warned that nationalistic sentiments being fueled in Ukraine could further provoke military conflict in the Donbas region. He said Moscow will act if it realizes it's necessary to ensure its security at its borders, especially. Now, tensions are running high between Russia and NATO countries following Moscow's military buildup along the border with Ukraine earlier this month. That after reports of renewed clashes between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russia forces in Donbas. Ukraine, the U.S., and NATO have accused Russia of propping up militias in the east of Ukraine, something that Moscow denies. The United States has ordered its non-essential staff to leave its Kabul embassy as Washington prepares to withdraw from Afghanistan. U.S. ambassador in Kabul said that the order affects a relatively small number of employees and embassy will continue operating, Ross Wilson added that the decision was made due to increasing violence and threats. He also noted that personnel urgently needed to help with the drawdown of U.S. troops from Afghanistan will remain in place. Earlier this month, the U.S. President Joe Biden announced that all American troops will be pulled out of the country by September 11th, ending Washington's longest war. Turkey has strongly rejected U.S. President Joe Biden's recognition of the alleged massacre of Armenians by Ottoman Turks during the First World War, that's right, as genocide. Many believe that the recognition will create further tensions between the two NATO allies. Rashan Saglam reports.
Turkey vowed to respond duly to U.S. President Joe Biden's recognition of the events of 1915 as a genocide. Back on Saturday, Joe Biden said the U.S. honors the victims of the Metz-Yeghern so that the horrors of what happened were never lost to history. He became the first U.S. president to officially recognize the alleged Armenian genocide. Immediately after Biden's declaration, Turkey's foreign ministry denounced him in strongest terms, saying the move does not have a scholarly and legal basis, nor is it supported by any evidence. The ministry also summoned the U.S. ambassador to Ankara to voice its protest against Washington. Meanwhile, Turkish defense minister said that the declaration by the U.S. president may disrupt peace in the region.
Historical events should not be used as a tool of conflict and setting an account. They should not be politicized. It is clear that such an environment will negatively affect ties between Turkey and Armenia, Turks and Armenians, as well as regional peace. It should be known that history cannot be rewritten through such political statements.
Relations between Turkey and U.S. have been in trouble, especially after U.S. imposed sanctions on Turkey for purchasing Russian-made S-400 missiles. Ankara is also still angry at Washington for supporting and aiding Kurdish militants in Syria, which Turkey considers as terrorists. This statement is seen by many as an addition to the pile of tensions between the two NATO allies.
I think the declaration by the U.S. President Biden will create further tensions between Ankara and Washington. The declaration is not legally binding. Turkey has always said it's ready to open its archive for evidence. However, the use of this card every now and then by Washington will create a strategic row between the two NATO allies.
Since Saturday, protests were held in front of the U.S. consulate in Istanbul, with demonstrators denouncing the statement and calling on Ankara to cut ties with Washington. Turkey often lodges a formal complaint when foreign governments describes the tragic wartime events in Ottoman Turkey as genocide. Ankara maintains that many people on both sides of the conflict lost their lives. It also proposed to the Armenian side on 2005 the establishment of a joint history commission to reach a just conclusion about the historical facts of that period. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Attorneys for the family of an African-American Andrew Brown Jr. who's fatally shot by North Carolina police last Wednesday, say that he was executed.
This, in fact, was a fatal wound to the back of Mr. Brown's head as he was leaving the site trying to evade being shot at by these particular law enforcement officers who we believe did nothing but a straight-out execution.
Lawyer said the 42-year-old man suffered four gunshot wounds to his right arm and a fatal shot to the back of his head as he drove away from Elizabeth City officers. Police say that they're trying to serve Brown with search and arrest warrants for drug-related offenses. FBI has opened a civil probe into this shooting. Man's death has led to six nights of protests in Elizabeth City. Anger is boiling in the U.S. over a growing number of incidents of police violence and racially charged conduct against the African-American community. And we should also add, Andrew Brown was an unarmed African-American gunned down by police, and relatives are asking for body cam footage and have yet to get it. Have gotten only 20 seconds thus far from Elizabeth City Police Department. Meanwhile, the Brazilian Senate has launched an inquiry into President Jair Bolsonaro's government's handling of the COVID pandemic. The probe is expected to focus on the government's delays in securing vaccines, including the details of drawn-out negotiations with foreign drug makers. Missteps in the states of the Amazonas, where an infectious new variant sprung up late last year, are also set to be probed. Bolsonaro has been in hot water due to his long-running efforts to undermine the dangers of the coronavirus, shun masks, and push unproven remedies, and also blasted vaccines. Inquiry into the government's lackluster response comes as Brazil remains the world's second-worst hit country in terms of fatalities, with nearly 392,000 deaths from the virus. South American nation has also registered over 4.3 million confirmed cases thus far. Now, each year during the holy month of Ramadan, charities in Afghanistan intensify efforts to offer more services to the needy. The Imam Khomeini Relief Committee from neighboring Iran is among the main charities which play a key role in fighting poverty in Afghanistan. Amin Alami has your story from Kabul.
Given the prevailing poverty in Afghanistan, active charities and relief organizations in the country normally increase their support to the most vulnerable people, mainly widows, orphans, and jobless people during the holy month of Ramadan. Imam Khomeini Relief Committee is one of the most active charity organizations in Afghanistan that has provided many services to Afghans, especially to poor families, since its establishment in Afghanistan at least two decades ago. Representatives of the Relief Committee of Imam Khomeini and Iranian Embassy in Kabul attended this iftari program at one of Kabul's orphanages as a show of support and respect to the culture of helping poor ones.
We view all Muslim countries, particularly Afghanistan, as our brothers. We look to them as our own people. Iran and Afghanistan enjoy too much commonalities in terms of cultural, religion, society, and many other fields. That is why we proudly do whatever in our power to help them.
The participation of the delegation of Iranian embassy in Kabul in events like this is usually welcomed by Afghans.
Iran is our neighbor and an Islamic country. We consider it as a brother nation who has always supported us in different fields such as culture, economy, politics, and social affairs, especially since the war began in Afghanistan.
As observers say, Iran is one of greatest supporters of Afghanistan that has extensively backed the people and governments of Afghanistan since decades ago. Currently, Tehran plays a key role in Afghanistan and is supporting Kabul's policies, especially in terms of bringing peace to the war-ravaged country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Thanks for tuning in and goodbye for now.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Austin's personal history and connection to the military and Raytheon mark him as a fitting Pentagon chief in an era of destructive militarism and creeping fascism in the U.S., says Jeremy Kuzmarov Ryder in an article titled, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has awarded over $2.36 billion in contracts to Raytheon since his confirmation in January. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. March 23rd was another good day for Raytheon, with a receipt of $63,300,000. $1,453 contract for repair of an APG G573 all-weather sensor radar system, which is operational in the U.S. Navy's F-18 fighter jets, and another $10,246,288 contract for repair of military jet engines. The company had yet more cause for celebration on March 30th, when Raytheon's Tucson, Arizona branch received a $130 million contract for upgrades to the Rolling Airframe Missile Block 2 to a guided missile round pack, which is designed to protect U.S. Navy ships from incoming missiles. The next day, two separate contracts amounting to $138 million, one for more F-35 maintenance work and another for the production of mine-hunting sonars. Though Austin claims to have recused himself from decisions involving Raytheon, the Pentagon under his direction is providing his old company with huge contracts on a daily basis that is bolstering its profits and stock price. Austin furthermore has used his new bully pulpit to advance for yet greater levels of military spending to the benefit of Raytheon. On February 25th, for example, on a visit to the USS Nimitz, Austin emphasized the need for U.S. warships throughout the globe to deter security threats. A week later, on a tour of Southeast Asia with Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Austin warned about China again and North Korean nuclear threat and pledged that the U.S. would maintain a robust military presence in the Indo-Pacific. He further cautioned North Korea that the U.S., following military exercises with South Korea, was ready to fight tonight. When fighting resumed in eastern Ukraine in early April, Austin assured Ukraine's defense minister, Andriy Taran, of the U.S. commitment to building the capacity of Ukraine's forces to defend more effectively against Russia, which was demonstrated by a recent $125 million military aid package, and took to Twitter to reaffirm the U.S. unwavering support for Ukraine's sovereignty, territorial integrity, and Euro-Atlantic aspirations. The latter implied the joining of the European Union and North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, which would inevitably escalate conflict between the world's two major nuclear armed powers, the U.S. and Russia. On April 13th, Austin announced that the U.S. would increase its military presence in Germany by about 500 personnel and was scuttling plans to introduce by President Donald Trump for a large troop reduction in Europe. Austin, meanwhile, in Tel Aviv, affirmed the U.S.-Israeli regime relationship, which receives a record $3.8 billion in U.S. military aid each year, and on a visit to Afghanistan stated that the Biden administration wanted to see a responsible end to the Afghan war, but that the level of violence must decrease for fruitful diplomacy to have a chance. These comments and many others were music to the ears of Raytheon, which gave $506,424 in donations to Biden's presidential campaign. Besides his connection to Raytheon, Austin's appointment as Pentagon chief was controversial because he had not been retired from the military for the requisite 7 years and required a legal waiver. Traditionally, the role of defense secretary is supposed to be a civilian position, ensuring the U.S. military apparatus is led not by a war fighter, but a policymaker. That requirement is laid out in the National Security Act of 1947 that established the Defense Department. Heralded as a soldier who would endure hardships with his troops, the Austin graduated from West Point in 1975 and led infantry troops in the capture of Baghdad during the 2003 Operation Iraqi Freedom. After a stint commanding the 10th Mountain Division in Afghanistan, Austin was appointed as Chief of Staff of U.S. Central Command at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, Florida, a high-tech command post where military officers could watch live imagery on plasma screens and order airstrikes through the Pentagon's secure internet server. Groomed for high military command by Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 2007 to 2011, Austin was appointed as commanding general of U.S. forces in Iraq in 2010 and commander of U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, which is responsible for military operations in the West Asia North Africa region by President Obama in 2013. In this latter capacity, Austin drafted a war plan approved by Obama that allowed the U.S. military for the first time to directly provide ammunition and weapons to Syrian opposition forces, who included terrorists. President Obama also endorsed General Austin's idea to increase the air campaign on Daesh from Incirlik Air Base in Turkey. The result was an increase in civilian deaths. Journalists Anand Gopal and Azmat Khat determined that 1 in 5 of 27,500 coalition airstrikes in the second Iraq war resulted in at least one civilian death, more than 31 times the number that was publicly acknowledged. Austin's personal history and connection to the military and Raytheon mark him as a fitting Pentagon chief in an era of destructive militarism and creeping fascism in the U.S., when civilians no longer control the key institutions of government and war industries ensure the perpetuation of endless wars from which they make obscene profits, the political system can no longer be defined as a democracy.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah. Who is الرحمن.
Allah.
Who is المنان.
لا إله إلا.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer questions, doubts, or misconceptions which are being asked or are sent to this radio station with regard to Islamic theology. For this, we try to invite Islamic scholars and speakers from Qom Seminary Schools. Like always, we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi to help us with his answer to the questions which are going to be asked concerning the holy month of Ramadan. The questions that we have and we shall pose and talk about are mostly in this very session about the holy month of Ramadan. Shaykhana, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
The question of the day actually is the continuation of the question that was posed in our last show. So that's why we try to, inshallah ta'ala, continue to talk about and discuss that question again. And what was the question? The question was, what is a good plan or the best plan? What do you recommend for the rest of the days and months that we have in year to be benefited from the blessings of the holy month of Ramadan? So we have only one golden month where Allah's blessings and bounties are showered on his beliefs, on his creatures. Now, how can we actually store these positive energy for the rest of the year? This was the question, and Sheikh Murtada Karmi, Islamic Scholar, actually touched upon this issue to some extent, but we left the whole answer to be given and presented to you today. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome. We are listening to you, Sheikh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As I mentioned in the previous program, if we want to continue acting upon what we gain in the Holy Month of Ramadan, first we need to know what we can gain during this holy month. I mentioned that according to the verse of chapter Baqarah, لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ, reaching taqwa and God-weariness is the main purpose for fasting. And a narration from the Holy Prophet reads that the best action during the Holy Month of Ramadan is to be away from maharim Allah, the forbidden actions. Now, there are some other spiritual things that we can gain during the Holy Month of Ramadan, and then we can have a program for keeping them after the Holy Month of Ramadan. One of them is the fact that through fasting during the Holy Month of Ramadan, we are able to be much more careful about the Day of Judgment. Mm-hmm. In one narration, the Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, وَذْكُرُوا بِجُوعِكُمْ وَعْتَشِكُمْ فِيهِ جُوعَ يَوْمِ الْقِيَامَةِ جُوعَ يَوْمِ الْقِيَامَةِ وَعْتَشَى. So as people being involved during the year in worldly affairs, we may not think about the Day of Judgment a lot, which is very unfortunate. But during the Holy Month of Ramadan, one of the spiritual gains is that according to this narration, the Holy Prophet says, through your hunger and thirst, remember your thirst and hunger on the Day of Judgment. So this is another spiritual lesson that we can gain during the Holy Month of Ramadan.
Very true.
Doing ihsan or benevolence. We know that the Holy Month of Ramadan is the month of paying charity and sadaqah. There are, many narrations about the virtues of giving ihsan, charity, sadaqah during the Holy Month of Ramadan. We can practice it during the Holy Month of Ramadan. It can become a habit for us, and then we can continue acting upon that after the Holy Month of Ramadan. The next point is taking benefit from the dawns, from the sahar during the Holy Month of Ramadan. Let me share sentences mentioned by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He says that in this busy world, if we are not able to take benefit from the time of sahar or dawn, we do not have any other time to have a privacy for ourselves, mm-hmm. for our heart, with our God. There is no other time. We are busy. In 24 hours, a couple of hours, we are sleeping. In the times that we are awake, every person has some worldly affairs. So Ayatollah Khamenei continues to say that in the past, we had some opportunities to have such free time, but today this is the force of the time. We have some new phenomena which were not there in the past. So according to Ayatollah Khamenei, the only time that we can have a privacy for ourselves and for our hearts between us and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is during sahar or dawn. Now, because of the fact that many Muslims, they get awake before dawn to eat suhoor, again, it can become a habit for the believers to continue to do that. Mm-hmm. So taking benefit from this time is a gracious blessing of the Holy Month of Ramadan. But many people, unfortunately, from the day of Eid al-Fitr, they continue to get awake after Adhan al-Sawab to say the morning prayer. But it would be great if people can practice that during the Holy Month of Ramadan. And
to wake up before Adhan.
Exactly, and to make it into a habit, doing tahajjud, night vigil. There are many stories, many statements by the great scholars about the virtues of night vigil. Maybe 10 minutes before Fajr, Adhan, it would be great. And gradually people can increase the time inshallah. So it is one of the great blessings of the holy month of Ramadan. The next point is reciting the Quran. Again, many Muslims, they do that during the holy month of Ramadan. We know that many people are able, through the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to do a khatb, to recite one juz every day, so that at the end of the month, they are able to read and recite the whole noble book of Quran. For 30 days, we are practicing that. Again, we can turn it and change it into a habit. Not one juz every day, at least 50 verses, according to some narrations. If not able, one page, two pages. I mean, we need to have this connection to the noble book of Quran. Ikhlas or sincerity is another spiritual...
So the next recommendation was to have this constant relation with the Holy Quran, recitation of the Holy Quran.
Yes.
So as it has been recommended to recite at least 50 verses of the Holy Quran per day, at least in other days. While in the holy month of Ramadan, we should not suffice with even one juz of it.
It depends. I mean, if people have the time, we have about the even the scholars. I mean, for the imams of the Ahlul Bayt, for the Prophet, we have in the narrations that they used to, do the khatm of the Quran several times during the holy month of Ramadan. We have the same stories about some of the great scholars. But maybe we can say, of course, this isn't a recommended act, but maybe the minimum which is expected from the believers is to do at least one khatm during the holy month of Ramadan and continue to have this connection with this noble book after the holy month of Ramadan. As I mentioned again, many people, unfortunately, right from the day of Eid al-Fitr, they forget about everything. They forget about paying charity, about... Salatul Layl, about reciting the Quran, and so on and so forth.
But Sheikh, this recitation of the Quran is very, I don't know, this is what I understood from actually text of hadith, from the tongue of the hadith, or the language of the hadith, that a person who does not recite 50 verses of the day will be included in the circle of ignorance, if I'm not mistaken, and the hadith goes well here. So we have to take refuge to God subhanahu wa ta'ala for this. At least we need to oblige ourselves to recite Quran. As for tahajjud, I have also another point to mention. Is it enough, Shaykh, just to at least practice tahajjud with two rak'ahs, at least slowly, slowly, but later on, inshallah, it will become a habit for us and we shall... perform the whole thing, with 11 rak'ahs.
Yeah, when it comes to tahajjud, the great scholars, they say that, first of all, it should be done in a gradual way, because we have seen some people that they begin by, for example, doing that for 1 hour or half an hour, but after 1 month, they get tired and exhausted, and they stop doing that altogether. So the point is that it should be gradual. For the first step, people may do that before going to sleep after, Shari midnight. Naturally between 11, 12 p.m., it is the beginning of Shari midnight, and people can read the Salatul Layl from that time onwards, but it's better to be said before Adhan stop. So in the first step, some people may do that if they are not able to be to get up before Fajr prayer. But then, as you mentioned, the next step would be just waking up. Maybe for 1 week or 2 weeks, you just try and practice to be able to wake up.
Very true.
Next, just to make a wudu. It's been mentioned by some of the scholars. Next, just reading and saying two rak'ah prayer, and gradually you would increase that into 11 rak'ahs. And it's very important to be done gradually and not force our heart to do the recommended action that we are not, inclined toward that. If it is done gradually, we will feel that interest to doing that more and more.
So waking up at that time before Adhan by itself is very important.
Exactly.
And breathing in that atmosphere, in the environment actually by itself is actually... influential in the human beings, but better to recite two rak'ahs, much more better to recite the whole thing, 11 rak'ahs.
Yes. There are stories, quoted from the great scholars, and they are astonishing, good for the people who are able to practice that. And many scholars of Irfan, they say that without tahajjud, you cannot continue treading the path of spirituality.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. Actually, up until now, you have given us and told us some recommendations on how to keep our connections with the whole month of Ramadan. One, with regard to tahajjud and staying awake before the Fajr, and second, having a constant program for recitation of the Holy Quran, and now we are listening to the rest.
You know, there are many things to learn from the holy month of Ramadan. As I mentioned, the best action is to be away from forbidden acts, reciting the Quran, doing tahajjud, ikhlas and sincerity is one of the blessings of fasting, repentance, tawbah, increasing the willpower. All these are the great effects and benefits of the holy month of Ramadan. But how we are able to keep doing them after the holy month of Ramadan? We have a concept in Islamic spirituality based on the narrations, and that is the concept of musharata, muraqabah, and muhasabatun nafs. I need to explain that. Mm-hmm. Imagine that we have make reciting the Quran a habit for us during the holy month of Ramadan. I'm talking about a recommended act. We can do that about being away, for example, from backbiting or from telling lies or any other forbidden action. This is an example. We can think of other examples as well.
True.
So after the holy month of Ramadan, I mean, every day early in the morning, we do musharata. We say that, oh Allah, I promise you that today I will recite 50 verses of the Noble Book of Quran. Mm-hmm. During the day, we do muraqabah. I mean, we think about that promise. We do that. And every night before going to sleep, we do muhasabah. We think about our actions, whether I was able to act upon that promise, which could be reciting the Quran or being away from backbiting and so on and so forth. So if we do that, on a daily basis, gradually we'll see great effects. And it could be confirmed and guaranteed by a nazr, a vow, for example.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if I'm a person suffering from backbiting, during the holy month of Ramadan, I practice that, but then I need a long program after the holy month of Ramadan. After the morning prayer, I say that, oh Allah, I promise you that today I will not backbite at all, for example.
Mm-hmm.
If I do that, I make a vow that for each backbiting, for example, I will fast for one day, or for example, I will pay $10 in charity. During the day, I will do muraqabah. At night, when I think about our actions, for example, I come to see that I have backbitten, for example, once, so I need to fast the following day because of the nab.
Right.
It would be pretty difficult. So the next day, I would be more careful about my actions.
Right.
Of course, the vow should be in a moderate way. For example, I shouldn't say that I will fast for 2 months if I backbite once, or I will pay $10 in charity. It should be something in a moderate way. So gradually, this program of musharata, muraqaba, muhasaba will, help
lead us, inshallah, to
keep the blessings of the holy month of Ramadan.
Are we done with this question, Sheikh?
Yes.
One more thing I think is good to be added to this, and inshallah, finalize the discussion. I think we have some days in a month, except the holy month of Ramadan, that are recommended to be fasting on those days. Again,
exactly.
I think if we keep fasting, for example, 3 days a month,
that's
or at least
point.
1 day per month, it is also another good connection with this
point,
holy month.
Yes.
Thank you, dear Sheikh, for your answers and these scholarly answers to the questions and enlightening answers which were given to the questions by you. And you, respected listeners, many thanks for staying tuned. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. إن في الجنة نهرا لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن علي لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لنا شميحا
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
According to the American academic and political commentator Marjorie Cohn, racist violence against black people and other minorities has been part of the very fabric of the United States. Marjorie Cohn also said that the recent violent incidents involving white police officers are part of systemic racist police violence against black people in America. We're prepared for an article written by Kelly Carter-Jackson. The Nuffel Assistant Professor of Humanities in the Department of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. The piece is titled, "The Derek Chauvin Verdict Won't Stop Cops Murdering Black People." The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Since May of last year, the world has been waiting for justice for George Floyd, who was killed on the streets of Minneapolis after allegedly trying to use a counterfeit $20 bill at a convenience store. The jury found police officer Derek Chauvin guilty on all counts: second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. It was an emotional verdict in what has been an emotional year since his killing. How are Americans to receive this moment? This verdict has been long time coming, and it's been a painful, difficult wait. Many times I have had to remind people that it was Derek Chauvin who was on trial and not George Floyd. Over and over, people questioned George Floyd's history, his drug use and his actions, anything that would shift the blame for his own death away from Derek Chauvin. As W.E.B. Du Bois, an American historian, civil rights activist, pan-Africanist, author, writer, and editor, once wrote, "Nothing in the world is easier in the United States than to accuse a black man of a crime." That is still true today. Despite all we have gone through, despite all the protests, activism, and calls for justice, we'll still see black people as criminals. Perhaps the most arduous task of the prosecution was not to prove that Derek Chauvin played a role in George Floyd's death, but to prove that George Floyd was in fact a human being. A deep-seated and pervasive culture of racism is to blame for the fact that his humanity was ever in question. As historians, the greatest opposition we can show white supremacy is to tell the truth. I have grown tired of politicians and pundits claiming that Derek Chauvin was a bad apple or an anomaly. No, the truth is, he is a mirror of white supremacy. The violence he committed was white supremacy in its purest form. For some, to mention this obvious fact is to be divisive. On Fox News Channel, Tucker Carlson issued a hateful diatribe about the trial, in which he said, "No one on CNN actually cares about George Floyd now. What they care about is you and your role in the systemic racism that supposedly killed George Floyd." Tucker Carlson said the purpose of speaking about racism is to punish you and to change America. He said that is why they are replaying that video of George Floyd dying on the sidewalk, to remind you of all that, of your culpability in his death. Tucker Carlson goes on to say that if the George Floyd Derek Chauvin trial ends up in acquittal, there could be riots. We accept that as a fact of life in this country. No civilized country should accept that, but suddenly we do. Apparently, Carlson thinks a civilized country should accept black Americans being killed in broad daylight by police officers. Much as Tucker Carlson and his ilk would like us to keep silent about white supremacy, we cannot and we will not. Since this trial began, 3 people a day have been killed by the police. Over half of these victims are black and Latino people. We will repeat it over and over and over again until black people stop being murdered in the streets by police officers. This is the audacity of white supremacy, that a white police officer could, in broad daylight, while being recorded among a gathering of witnesses, kneel on a black man's neck until he dies. He kneeled despite the fact that George Floyd told him he couldn't breathe, and he kept kneeling despite the fact that Floyd told him he was going to die. In this country, a black athlete like Colin Kaepernick can't peacefully kneel on the ground in protest without backlash. Yet, a white police officer can kneel on a black man's neck until he dies. The verdict doesn't take away from that fact. It's hard to know if Derek Chauvin ever recognized George Floyd's humanity. That's what made the weeks of questions and cross-examination of witnesses that took place so gruelingly to watch. I watched Derek Chauvin's body language throughout the trial. He always appeared indifferent. What notes was he taking? What, if any, testimony moved him to feel empathy? In the 9 minutes 29 seconds that Derek Chauvin's knee was on George Floyd's neck, all I saw was defiance on his part. He was a belligerent cop who was not going to be told how to do his job. Derek Chauvin never exhibited remorse. But even if he did, remorse does nothing to further justice. Rendering George Floyd's death as a series of unfortunate events does nothing to alter violent outcomes for black people. Make no mistake, a conviction for Derek Chauvin is not equivalent to a vaccine that will protect us from death and injury. A prison sentence will not protect black people from the violence of the police. Black men, women and children are still being killed by the police. There are no winners in this outcome. An acquittal is not justice. A conviction is not justice. In America, we have never seen justice because justice is a system that fully recognizes black humanity. And we are far from a justice system like that. The stakes of white supremacy do not start or even end with this verdict. George Floyd's family will never recover his life, his love, or laughter. Black Americans will not cease to be seen as threats, and Derek Chauvin will walk away as the exception rather than the rule. Racist violence against black people and other minorities has been part of the very fabric of the United States. Recent violent incidents involving white police officers are part of a systemic racist police violence against black people in America. Marjorie Cohn, who is a professor emeritus at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego, California, and also a former president of the National Lawyers Guild, made the remarks in an online interview recently. From the day witnesses began to testify in the Derek Chauvin trial on 29th of March through to 18th of April, at least 64 people in the United States died at the hands of law enforcement. More than half of those victims were black and brown. During the trial, 20-year-old Duane White was shot and killed by a police officer very close to the courthouse where Derek Chauvin was being tried. The police officer claimed she was reaching for her taser, but grabbed her gun instead. Even if she had used the taser, that would have constituted a use of excessive force. These are not isolated occurrences, but rather part of systemic racist police violence against black people in the United States. The new US President Joe Biden is claiming that he supports police reform and supposedly is a vast improvement over his predecessor, Donald Trump, but he cautioned, don't expect him to propose real systemic change, including defunding and abolition of the police. The United States was established in the wake of a long history of slavery and committed genocide on the indigenous population of the United States. From the slave codes to the black codes, racist violence has been part of the very fabric of this country. Jim Crow laws, which followed Reconstruction, kept African Americans oppressed. That legacy is embodied in today's policing, which is steeped in systemic and racist violence.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.